Hello and welcome to A Gay Old Time. My name is Nigel May. You may know me from things I've presented on the TV. You may know me as a host from my radio shows, or you may have read one of my novels. You may not know me at all, and that's just fine. But anyone who does know me will know that I am very proud to be a gay man and hugely proud to be part of a beautiful queer community. This podcast is a celebration of that community, of its many beautiful people, people of all ages, people who have fought with their emotions and who have faced struggles and emerged victorious, who have had to tread their own path in life to live their real truth. People who inspire, who aspire, and who always entertain. People who matter. Each episode, I'll speak to a person from our LGBTQIA+ rainbow, discuss their journey and their thoughts on our rich and varied queer community. One person, one life, one conversation, and I can guarantee a gay old time. My guest today is Paul Burston, journalist and author and a man who has been described as the senior statesman of queer culture. He edited the LGBT section of Time Out magazine for several years and is the author of many best-selling books. He's also the curator and the host of the award-winning literary salon Polari and founder of the Polari Prize Book Awards for LGBTQ+ writers. He has been on the front line promoting freedom, equality and LGBTQ+ rights around the world for decades. He's a Rainbow List National Treasure and former AIDS activist with ACT UP London. Alongside ACT UP, Paul has also worked with the Gay London Police Monitoring Group Gallup, where he would answer calls from the organisation's switchboard. His memoir, We Can Be Heroes, is essential reading, and it's been described as an illuminating memoir of the 80s, 90s and noughties from a gay man who only just survived them. Without Paul, our community would not be where it is today. Paul, welcome to A Gay Old Time. So now let's say hello and welcome to A Gay Old Time, Mr. Paul Burston.
Hello, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine, sir. It is a joy to be with you. Paul, it seems like you've always been in my gay old life, quite frankly, because I don't remember a time when there wasn't Paul Burston doing really important things in this world. But can I go back to right to the beginning, to you as a little queer boy, maybe feeling those earliest memories of otherness. Take me back to those early days. What were you like as a child?
I was a very quiet, introspective child. I came from a very unhappy marriage, and my father wasn't very nice. And I was sort of singled out by other kids from a very young age. I was bullied from, you know, as long as I can remember, really. And I can remember feeling very different from other kids by about six, seven. And I think infant school was okay, but once I got to junior school, it was really pronounced by then. I was also quite a show-off because I used to write these stories with my friend Caroline. I used to write the stories and she used to illustrate them. And the headmaster used to bring us up in morning assembly to read these stories out. And then I would get bullied in the playground for showing off. So there was a bit of me that was fighting back, you know, in that kind of way, being creative, not letting them sort of beat it out of me, really, I guess. There was a kind of defiance there, but I was quite different to how I am now. I was quite quiet and introspective. I wasn't really a performer. I wasn't really somebody that sort of drew attention to myself very much, apart from the writing. So the writing was always there, and that was my sort of escape. I always loved books, and I always loved writing stories and reading stories. So that's been part of my DNA since I was very young.
So the story writer in you was there from the beginning. What about your sexuality? Were you aware of like an otherness within you at that stage in your life?
I was aware of being different. I didn't know what the difference was. I didn't know what gay was or anything like that. But I knew that I was different, and I was often, most of my close friends were girls rather than boys when I was little. I had a friend called Andrew when I was little, and we were very close. And then something happened. I don't know what was said, but basically my parents were invited over to his parents' house. And then we were basically seated separately in school after that. So I think there was a sense that I wasn't a good influence or something like that. So I became aware of that and sort of became quite, what's the word, just painfully conscious of it. And so it was that thing where you try and sort of blend in and try not to sort of be yourself, and you try and kind of tone it down. So I remember that period. I think a lot of boys go through this. I mean, I've got a nephew who's eight, and I don't believe for a second that he is gay particularly, but there's a certain point in little boys' life where they suddenly become really self-conscious about being affectionate with other boys. And it happens to all boys, gay and straight. And it happened to me, certainly. And I think that was what happened when I was about that age, that I wasn't meant to be so close to him. It was a bit suspicious. Bearing in mind, this was the early 70s. You know, this was in South Wales in a small town, quite backwards in those days. And there wasn't really much in the way of queer representation. So one wasn't aware of gay characters on television or anything like that. So, or certainly not in books. And so there was a sense of being alone. I felt very, very isolated and very alone. And it was a kind of shameful secret that I had to keep to myself and not tell anybody. And I learned to do that from a pretty young age. And I remained like that, actually, until I was about 19. So for a long part of my life, I was just basically repressing everything and denying it to myself because I couldn't face it, because it was just too frightening a prospect, because there was nothing to reassure you that it was okay. You know, and my mum was a lovely, my mum is a fantastic woman. I love her dearly, you know, but she's a product of her time. And so if somebody has pointed out that I was a bit of a puff, which they often did use that word about me when I was little, she would be mortified by that. She was horrified at the thought of that. She wanted me to be, you know, like everyone else's kid, not to be different, because she knew that being different would mean that I was singled out and bullied for it. So I think that sort of sense of being protective of your kid and not having anywhere else to turn for reassurance that it was okay or for information, then you end up living in this very, very small little bubble where you turn in on yourself. You know, it's a very damaging thing that happens to us as queer kids psychologically, the damage that causes. I think we turn in on ourselves. We're literally taught to hate ourselves, and the shame that comes with that is a really difficult thing to process and to grow out of. And it took me a long time, and it took me a lot of reading, a lot of immersing myself in the bits of queer culture that I could find in my teenage years, because I discovered David Bowie and I discovered punk and I discovered sort of music and pop culture that was celebrating difference. And that was a lifesaver for me. But until then, until I was sort of 14, 15, I really had nothing to reference myself with. You know, I find it very difficult to be who I thought I probably was, because there was nowhere to sort of, I was a very tribal kid. You know, I'm a product of that time when pop culture was very, very tribal. You know, I can remember punk. I was about 12 when punk happened, 11. And I remember after punk, there was a kind of revival of the mods, sort of mod culture. And then that you're reminded of the mods versus the rockers and all that kind of thing. So it's very, very tribal, and you define yourself by what you're not. You're part of this gang, not that gang. And I was never part of any gang. There wasn't a gang for me, you know. There wasn't a gang of like Bowie kids or anything like that. So it took until sort of mid-teens, really, until I was able to find a place in that sort of teenage world that actually where I fitted. And that was basically a world of other people who were odd or misfits in different ways. It was a very, very white town. There were very, very few non-white faces in Bridgend at that time when I was growing up. One of my closest friends was a young guy called Rafik, who was from Uganda. One of the Ugandan Asians that was kicked out of Uganda by Idi Amin. And he came to my school when I was very little, and I befriended him because he was different as well. So there was that sense of being other within this sort of very, very straight white culture. So I think those friendships sort of sustained me, but I didn't feel when I was that age that I could risk telling those friends about myself, because I still feared that they would reject me. So I may have been wrong about that. And actually, I'm still friends with Rafik now, and I'm still friends with people that I knew when I was very little now. And the reality is that they probably wouldn't have rejected me, but I wasn't to know that at the time. So it was a very, very long, narrow little world that I was trapped in, and I felt that there was no escape from it. And the only way out of it was education, which is how I'd got out in the end.
So you mentioned about obviously your mum, and you know, we all had that awkward conversation when we were young or whatever time in life it came along when we have to say to our mum, actually, mum, this is me, this is the true me. When did that conversation happen with your mum?
It happened quite late. I mean, I came out to, the first time I told anyone else that I was gay, I was 19. And that was my friend Tracy from college. And we'd gone back to Bridgend to visit my parents during the holidays. I think it was Easter holidays. And everyone, my parents kept referring to her as my girlfriend, and I kept correcting them. She was my friend. And we went to this beach called Southern Down, where I used to go as a kid. And we were on the beach clowning around. It was winter time, there were these amazing sandstone cliffs in Southern Down, and there were these incredible ice formations. I'd never seen them before or since from the freak cold weather. And it was so other and so alien that I felt the landscape had changed. And it was actually safe to say something outlandish because everything felt so different. And we were joking and playing around, and she suddenly said to me, "Oh, Paul, are you gay?" And I said, "Yes, no, I don't know," and got upset and cried. After I came out to Tracy, I came out to pretty much everyone in my circle, certainly at college, but I didn't tell my parents. And part of the reason for that was that my personal tutor, who was like a real mentor to me, Gerard, who I'm still close to, advised me not to tell my parents because I was in London, they were in South Wales, they wouldn't be able to see my life or see the people that I was hanging out with. And bearing in mind, this was 1985, which meant that AIDS was all over the headlines, and they would just worry about me. So I decided I wouldn't tell them. And once I'd made that decision, it was very difficult to undo that then, because I'd kind of avoided the conversation. I did take a boyfriend home, introducing him as a friend. And the plan was that once they'd actually met Mark and they knew him as a real person, then I could tell them that actually he was my boyfriend. I think my stepfather suspected, because he kept making little sort of jokes, and not in a mean way, but sort of playful way. My mum had no idea. And the plan to come out to them was sort of rather sort of sabotaged, because I found out that Mark was cheating on me. And so the relationship ended. And I didn't want to go to them as a kind of sad gay. I wanted to go to them as a happy gay with a boyfriend, you know. I would have been about 23. And I wrote my mum a letter, and I copied it from Armistead Maupin's Tales of the City, when Michael Tolliver writes letter to Mama. I actually used that letter as a template, which Armistead said afterwards, when I finally met him years later, that was his intention, that people would use it as a template. And I wrote to my parents, and I didn't hear anything back. And I phoned home to speak to them, and my stepdad answered. My stepdad is an Irish builder, very working class, really lovely, lovely man. And I phoned home, and he answered the phone and said my mum was a bit upset and she would take a few days to come round and leave it to him, and he would work on her. And sure enough, you know, a couple of days later, she phoned me back and we talked. It took her a bit of a while. I think for my mum, it was quite a difficult adjustment to make, because she, like many people of that era and in that place, was very much obsessed with what the neighbours thought about everything, and wanting to be like everyone else and fit in. And I was the golden child. I was the academic when I was her firstborn. I was the only boy. I was, you know, academic, and I was at university and all that kind of thing. And suddenly there was this sort of spanner in the works, as far as she could see, that I wasn't going to be, you know, the person that she'd hoped I would be. And she was, I think there was a disappointment there. And I think it's fine to acknowledge that as well. I think, you know, for parents of queer kids, certainly back then, there would have been a sense of disappointment. And also there was a genuine sense, as my tutor said, that they were worried about me, because I'm living in a city which they know nothing about. They don't know who I'm with or what I'm doing. And there is this frightening news coverage about this deadly new disease which is affecting gay men and killing gay men. My mum is a nurse, and she's retired now. And shortly after this, a doctor who came to work in the hospital, a male doctor, came out to my mum and to all the nurses, and then got ill, contracted HIV and became very, very ill and died. And that was a huge journey for my mum. She went from not knowing any gay people to knowing a gay person and really liking them. And he was very charming, and all the nurses loved him. Then sadly he got ill, and that was a big turning point for her. She began to understand, because by this point I was involved in ACT UP, and I was going on these AIDS activist demonstrations, partly because a friend of mine had been diagnosed, and I wanted to sort of do something positive and constructive about it, and I didn't know what else to do. So I became an AIDS activist, and I knew that there would be photographs of me and possibly you know, news footage of me getting arrested on these demonstrations. So I knew I had to tell my parents. They needed to know why I was there. At the time, I thought that she was quite embarrassed by that. But later on, I mean, quite recently, actually, she gave me this pile of scrapbooks that she kept. And in there, there is cuttings from every single demonstration that I was on from about 1989 onwards that she kept, you know. And I was really touched by that. But even though she wouldn't say it to me, because we're not that kind of family, we're not very you know, we don't speak about our emotions very much in my family. She was very proud. I think at the time I wasn't aware of that, and it would have been nice to have known that at the time, because I felt like I was this troublesome child causing embarrassment to the family. But I had to do what I was doing because it was the right thing to do. But I was aware that it was difficult for my parents because, you know, I was in London and there was nobody around me to sort of look at me with disapproval, although I did experience that to some degree. But it wasn't like I was concerned about other people's opinion of me by that point. I was at a Catholic college and I was running around, you know, being overtly gay and overtly political and making a lot of noise. And for my parents, they weren't in that environment. They were in this very small town environment where people didn't really, you know, people frowned upon stuff like that. So it was a difficult thing for them. And I think I didn't really appreciate at the time quite how difficult it was. But over a couple of years, we kind of came to an understanding, and they've been very supportive of me ever since then.
Did you feel that you wanted to keep very much your London life and your back home family life very separate at that point? Because I think we all want to have that fairy tale coming out to our parents and saying, you know, the happy gay experience, as you mentioned before. But, you know, sadly, not everything in life does have that happy ever after ending. So it's like, was there a conscious kind of like feeling of wanting to keep the two separate because you didn't want to face the inevitable of actually having to tell them at some point?
Very much so, very much so. And I was obsessed with Oscar Wilde from my teenage years onwards. And I appeared in a school production of The Importance of Being Earnest. And in The Importance of Being Earnest, there's a character who's called Bunbury, and that's a kind of euphemism for somebody who's leading a double life, where he's one person in the town and another person in the country. That was me. I was Bunburying. You know, I was splitting up my life into my college life, where I was out and everyone knew I was gay and it wasn't a problem. Well, not with most people, but obviously with some people it was. And then my life when I went home to visit my family, where I was still not out to them at this point, where I just became the person I was before I left home. I kind of regressed back into being this sort of closeted, unhappy teenager, which is why I didn't go home that much. I went home as little as possible for a couple of years. I found it very difficult to go home and to give up those freedoms and just shed off that person that I was becoming and sort of go back into that teenage closet. I mean, my parents still live in the same house to this day. So when I go home now, I'm still sleeping in the bedroom, maybe not the same mattress, but the same bedroom where I was living as a young teenager. And I was a deeply unhappy teenager. You know, I had a very difficult time in my early teens. When I go back there, I kind of feel myself regressing. Still to this day, I can still feel that sense of going backwards in time. But for a long time, I kept the two things very separate. And I would have my home life when I went back to South Wales, where I would see my old friends. I think some of them probably suspected. I mean, I remember saying to my friend John, who is straight and a complete teenage freak like me, we used to all dye our hair and wear makeup and earrings and all these outrageous clothes. John is totally straight. And I remember saying to him at that time, oh, I can't wait to go to college where I can be where I can reinvent myself. And he was like, oh, Paul's obviously coming out of the closet. You know, it was a kind of joke, but it was never acknowledged that there was truth to it until much later. So for a couple of years while I was at college, I kept those two worlds separate. Once I'd left college and moved into my second flatshare, which was my second gay flatshare, my landlord flatmate was a gay guy, everything changed then, and I became much more political about it and felt I had to make a stand, and that meant telling my parents. But until the age of 23, I managed to keep those. So from 19 to 23, I kept the two, my gay life and my kind of previous life, separate, very much so.
Was college where you started to find your tribe then, as it were, Paul?
It was. I mean, I found a tribe already in South Wales. I found this tribe of, you know, alienated outsider freak boys, you know, who I hang out with, all of whom were completely heterosexual. But it was the early 80s, so it wasn't uncommon for men to wear eyeliner and to dress up. And it was, you know, it was that era of New Romantics and Culture Club and all that kind of stuff, and Marc Almond. And so they were kind of my first tribe, but I didn't really find my sort of proper tribe until much later, which was I came to London. I went to Heaven on my own on a Saturday night in February 1985, and it was men only, and it was all, well, my memory of it anyway certainly is that when I went there looking like this sort of freaky guy with spiked up hair and eye makeup on, and everyone else looked like members of the Village People. I mean, it was like Cloneville, wall to wall. And I didn't fit in, and I didn't feel comfortable in that men only club at that point either. I felt really this wasn't the right environment for me. And so I discovered sort of months later that there were these midweek alternative nights, Pyramid, Asylum. And not only were they mixed, men and women, but also they played the music that I actually listened to at home. So they didn't play high energy gay disco. They played alternative music. They played David Bowie. They played Culture Club. They played Prince. And so I used to go to those nights. And that was where I first felt that I'd found my proper tribe, I sort of alternative gay world, which is always the one where I felt most comfortable.
I mean, you seem such a confidence man to, I think, anybody that has, you know, looked at what you have done in your life and what you do for our queer community. So it's kind of quite humbling to find out that you weren't that confident from the beginning as well. You mentioned about ACT UP earlier. Now, we must talk, because I'm sure there might be people listening to this podcast who maybe only know about ACT UP and activism through things like It's a Sin. For people like you and I that were there in the 80s, I mean, ACT UP, I mean, let's explain what it was and how you actually became involved in that in the first place.
Okay, so my friend Vaughan, who I was, the flat chair I mentioned, he was my landlord and flatmate, and Vaughan was very political, very, very much about the community and very politically active. And I used to go to Gay Pride with him and stuff like that. And we went on the march against Section 28. And then when I was 23, so that would be 1989, end of 1988, disclosed to me, by this point I was living with my cousin in another part of London in Blackheath. And I went to visit Vaughan for dinner, and I could tell when I got to the flat that something was different. I just knew something was different. He'd been very, very quiet for quite a while. I hadn't seen him for a while. And I went for dinner and we were just chatting. And the last time I'd seen him, he'd come to see a play that I was performing in. And he'd come with this boyfriend of his. And he'd not had a boyfriend as long as I'd known him. So we went for this dinner at his house. I arrived there, sit down for dinner, and we're just chatting. And I said, oh, how are things with the new boyfriend? And he said, oh, we split up because he can't handle the fact that I don't want sex since I discovered I'm HIV positive. And that was how he told me. And then he just changed the subject. And I left the flat so upset. And because in those days, in 1989, the prognosis of people told they were HIV positive wasn't very good. There wasn't effective treatment. So people were getting ill and dying for the most part. Obviously, there were exceptions, but for the most part, that was the story. So I became very, very upset about this. And I knew that if I didn't find a constructive outlet, that I would go into a self-destructive mode. I have this side to my character, which is I'm very compulsive. I thought if I don't find an outlet for this, which is constructive and helpful, I'm going to end up just going out clubbing and taking lots of drugs and drinking too much and all that kind of thing. So I was looking through Capital Gay newspaper, which is a free newspaper and used to pick up in the bars and clubs. And I saw this advert. People were meeting at the London Lesbian and Gay Centre in Farringdon to form a ACT UP group based on ACT UP in America. And ACT UP was an AIDS activist group founded by Larry Kramer and others. And ACT UP stood for AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. So it was a grassroots organization of affected people and allies to raise awareness around HIV and the prejudice and the obstacles people were facing in those days. In America, the battle was much more about drugs and getting the drugs. In the UK, it was much more about sort of social stigma, benefits, all the kind of things that would affect us in our National Health Service culture. So I went to that first meeting, just threw myself into it, and it just took over my life completely. I just gave everything to ACT UP for a couple of years. And the very first demonstration we ever staged, which was in February 1989, was at Pentonville Prison, because prisons weren't allowing condoms and needle exchanges inside prisons. And we know for a fact that lots of people in prison, men, have sex with other men, however they identify. So we were catapulting condoms over Pentonville prison walls. That was our first demo. And it was disastrous because we quickly discovered that if you put a condom in a tin foil inside a catapult and catapulted. He doesn't go very far because it's not dense enough. So it's not like, you know, a pebble or a ball bearing, you know, it would just flutter down. So then we tried inflating the condoms and trying to float them over on the wind. But it was really just a photo opportunity, really. It was photographed by the gay press, and we managed to get the story out into the gay free sheets. And I really loved being involved in ACT UP. It was a real sense of community. It was a real sense of people. I mean, it was a horrible time, and I'm not taking away from that. It was a really horrible time in lots of ways. We were under attack as a community. Section 28 had gone through. There was so much homophobia in the mainstream media, and that was partly fueled by the AIDS crisis. But it was open season on people like us, you know, and to be part of a group that was actually fighting back gave me a huge sense of self-worth. And a huge sense of, I can do this. I was a kid who was bullied and never, ever fought back as a kid. I used to stand there and just be hit. And I would just stand there and freeze and be hit. When I joined ACT UP, it was like I was fighting for the first time. And it was the first time that I'd actually fought back. You know, people used to be on our demos, we would shout, ACT UP, fight back, fight AIDS. So it was a sense of being a fighter. That was a really powerful message. And it was a turning point in my life. I think it was where I became the person that I am now, really. It's where I sort of stopped running and stopped cowering and started sticking up for myself and trying to make positive change in the world. I hadn't really seen that as being a possibility until then. And I think when you're backed into a corner and being living through the AIDS crisis, one was backed into a corner, you have two choices. You either go down or you come out fighting. And I chose to come out fighting. And it was a very empowering experience in so many ways. It gave me friendships and gave me confidence I would never have had otherwise. And it taught me that you can make a difference, even if you're just one person or a group of 12 people. ACT UP wasn't huge. I mean, there was about 100 people involved in it over the period that I was involved. But there was only about a dozen of us that were actually people that got arrested, because many people couldn't afford to get arrested because they had jobs or family to worry about. And I wasn't worried about that because I was on the dole and doing casual work. So I was quite happy to be arrested, but that was 12 people. So those 12 people, among, you know, just the actions of those 12 people was able to affect change, was able to raise awareness, was able to get messages out into the mainstream media. And that to me was a huge, hugely important life lesson, that you don't need thousands of people on a march to change things. You can just do something with a group of people that is very small.
That's such a beautiful legacy to the world, Paul, as well, to know that you've made such a difference. I've read many an article from you about that time, you know, with quotes that are, you know, heartbreaking, like, you know, I was burying a lot of my friends at the age of 23. But to look, it sounds like, listening to you now, that your memories of that time are predominantly quite happy memories.
They are, that because that's what I choose to take from it. At the time, it wasn't a very happy time in my life. I was very traumatized. It isn't normal to be burying your friends when you're 23. It's a very, very upsetting thing to go through. And of course, also, given the nature of what was happening, it wasn't just the sense of loss and grief. It was also the fear that you might be next, because none of us knew. I was somebody who knew that if I go and get tested and they tell me I'm positive, I'll probably end up killing myself. I mean, that's how I felt about it at the time, because it was such a frightening thing. I'd seen these really healthy men wither away before my eyes, and I didn't want to be the next one to do that. And I was so frightened of getting tested that I didn't get tested until many years later. Actually, I just put it all down and just buried it all inside me and didn't face up to it at all. I think that was quite common at the time. I think there were lots of people that did that. I think many people that I knew only got tested when they suddenly discovered they had symptoms. There was also, you know, lots of disincentives, because you couldn't get a mortgage, for example, things like that. So there were lots of things discouraging one from getting tested for HIV back in those days, as well as the fact that the prognosis was so bad. What was the point? My attitude was, what's the point of knowing anything if you can't affect change anyway? What's the point of knowing? There's not effective treatment. There was AZT, which was the only medication around at that time. And many people thought that that was actually hastening people's illness because it was such a toxic drug. Vaughan took AZT and he was gone in the space of like 18 months, 2 years, you know? So there wasn't much to encourage you to take that path. So it wasn't a positive time on the whole. It was a really horrible time, and I wouldn't swap it for anything. I mean, I would happily not have lived through that if I had the choice. But having lived through it, you have to think, well, what came out of it that was actually beneficial or positive for me? And there were some positives. So I focus on those. That isn't to say that it wasn't a really horrible time. And I deeply regret everything that I had to live through. And I mean, I'd give anything to have those people back, you know, people that we lost, to have them back. So I don't like that kind of, there's silver lining. People talk about this, there was a silver lining to the AIDS crisis because we found a sense of community again. And I'm not sure about that, you know. I'm not happy with that, really. I think I'd rather not have lived through it. But given that we did, those of us who are lucky enough to still be here, let's try and think about what good things came out of it for us personally and for us as a community. But it doesn't mean that we wouldn't happily not have lived through it. I'd have happily not lived through that, you know.
It's a period in your life, along with many other great periods, that you have documented beautifully in your memoir, We Can Be Heroes. Your literary work, your words, I mean, you know, I'm an author, so it's like, to me, you are up there on a pedestal when it comes to writing. Co-founder of Attitude, I mean, you were in charge of the LGBT section of Time Out for a long time as well. Many best-selling books. I mean, you've done so much when it comes to words. I imagine that We Can Be Heroes, getting that memoir out there, must have been a beautifully cathartic moment, but also a totally different moment in your literary career to actually have your memoir out there.
It was a very big moment. I wouldn't have written it had it not been for Alexis Gregory, who invited me or asked me if I would be interviewed for a play that became Riot Act. And I'd never talked about that part of my life very much. I kind of like, once that part of my life was over, once I was no longer involved in activism in a direct way like that, sort of by the sort of mid 90s, and by that point the whole HIV story was changing. People were now living with HIV on very effective medication. All that stuff changed. I didn't really dwell on it or go back to it very often because it was a very traumatic period, you know. I remember interviewing David Weissman, who made a documentary called We Were Here about people living through the AIDS crisis. And I interviewed him. And at that point, I was still somebody who wasn't talking about what I'd gone through. I was somebody who was still, I boxed it all away in the past. Don't dwell on it. Don't think about it. And I realized when I went for therapy, which was round about this time, I mean, I guess about sort of 8 years ago now. And I went for therapy and discovered that I was suffering from post-traumatic stress and survivor guilt, all of things which make absolute sense. But I was so surprised. They came as a surprise to me at the time because I had no idea that these things even existed, you know. So I did the play with Alexis where he interviewed me about being involved in ACT UP. He knew I was in therapy. He knew I would probably write about it myself at some point. And I saw him performing that extract from the play. It was three different monologues in the play. And when I saw the reaction from audiences, because he performed it often at Polari, at various venues around the country, and I saw the reaction from audiences and realised that it was time for me to tell the full story, because obviously in Riot Act, it's just a little section of my life. Had it not been for COVID, I would have probably not written it just quite so... I wouldn't have written it now, I'd have written it later possibly, but I was meant to be writing another novel, and then we went into lockdown. And I just found it impossible to write fiction under lockdown conditions. I couldn't do it. And friends who aren't writers couldn't understand this because they thought that would be ideal for a writer just locked up at home. It's like, no, that's not how I write. I need to be out in the world interacting with people. That's what feeds my imagination. I can't just sit at home locked up and write a novel because I can't sustain that sense of suspension of disbelief in a world that I'm creating on my computer if I'm not out in the world feeding my imagination. I couldn't do it. So I got writer's block. And, you know, as a journalist of many years, I don't really suffer from writer's block as a rule. So it was a bit of a shock to me to suddenly be blocked. And my agent, David, bless him, said, well, why don't you think about that memoir we talked about? So I sat down, and also at the beginning of COVID, I think it's easy to forget now, but at the start of COVID, we didn't really know how it was transmitted. We didn't know what the risks were, how deadly it was, what the chances were if you did catch it, that you'd end up in hospital, all those questions. And that brought back so many anxieties that were so familiar to me from living through the AIDS epidemic. All that sense of fear of other people, fear of contagion, all those anxieties that the whole country was feeling those are feelings that I'd gone through before when I was very young. So it kind of felt like, well, this is the right moment now. This is the right moment. I'm living through another epidemic. I'm living through a time where people, the wider population, is living through a similar experience to the one that I lived through in an isolated community back then. This is the time to write this book. So I make the comparison in the book that, you know, we were living through an epidemic, and it was one in which everyone was pulling together. Well, apart from the government, of course, but everyone in the community was pulling together to sort of get through this epidemic. But quite different to what happened during the AIDS crisis, which is that small pockets of the population were affected. Our community and other minority communities were affected, but the population at large carried on as normal, you know? And if anything, there was disdain and even horror and disgust at what we were going through, not sympathy. There wasn't much in the way of sympathy for people with HIV and AIDS back in 1989. There really wasn't. Newspaper headlines about vicars saying they'd happily shoot their son if they were HIV positive and things like that. I mean, it was a horrendous time. So I just felt like, well, this is a good opportunity now to write this story. The ACT UP part of my life is kind of, it's in the middle of the memoir, and it's kind of the turning point in my life. So it makes sense that it's there because it's a really big moment. And it's sort of it sort of hinges on that, really. It's where I became the person that I am to some degree, well, to a large degree. And to write it under those conditions just felt natural because we were living through something that felt similar in some way. So I thought, well, this is the time to write it. So it was very cathartic. I got very tearful writing it. I had memories that I didn't know that I had. One of the things I found interesting about memory is that, you know, you have the memories that you know that you've got. You've got those episodes, those events in your life that you tell other people about when you meet them, and you tell stories about, and you don't always remember the little things that happened in between. And when you actually sit down and write it down, the process of writing often triggers other memories that you didn't know you had. So I found myself dealing and processing emotions I hadn't really dealt with. As I was writing it, I was suddenly having these other recollections that were quite buried. You know, something happens when you go through a process of multiple grief in a short space of time, i.e. you're burying a dozen people in the space of a year or whatever, you don't process it properly. When Vaughan died, I went to Vaughan's funeral, and a few months later I was at another funeral for somebody else. And during the funeral for somebody else, I was crying and suddenly realized I was crying for Vaughan and not for the person that we were burying that day. And that's what that compounded grief is like. It's a really difficult thing to live through. Memory is a bit like that. The memories get sort of trapped and buried with those recollections, you know? And when I was writing the book, they were all coming up. It was like all these things were surfacing, and it was a very emotional experience. And I've done quite a lot of events already for this book, and every time I read in public, I tend to read from the ACT UP chapter, and I'm prepared, I think, for how I'm going to feel when I'm reading it. And every time a different line catches me and I suddenly find myself choking up, every single time. And it's a different line. It's not the line that I think it's going to be. It's not the bit that I think, well, I'm prepared for this. I'm now going to read out this bit about this person dying or this horrible thing that happened. And no, and something else catches me instead, because all of it is so emotive, you know. The one note that my agent gave me when I was writing was, he said, tell us how you're feeling. At each point in your book, when you're describing your journey and what's happening to you, think about how did I feel? How did I feel? How did I feel? Because it's the emotional impact that's going to carry the story. And as a novelist, you tend not to necessarily think of that as being the only thing to think about. You tend to think about structure and story and plot and all those things. And for the first draft of the book was very much a novelist's version of the story. And I had to go back and change so much to take all that, take the writer out of it, just to make it much more of a just straightforward confessional in a way, you know, this is what happened, this is how I felt. Also, as an author, you know, I write crime novels now, and as a crime novelist, you do lots of foreshadowing. So you often write a chapter where there'll be, you know, a little event will happen that isn't that sinister, but the protagonist will think of it as being sinister, and maybe it's a hint of what's to come around the corner. And as a novelist, you kind of work with those things. You kind of build up tension by hinting at things to come. And I did that a lot when I wrote the memoir. And of course, that's the wrong thing to do in a memoir. You shouldn't be hinting at what's to come, because you don't know what's to come. You're the person living it. You're not the author outside of it. You're the person living it. You can't be hinting at what's to come, because why would you know? You know what I mean? So when I read memoirs that kind of jump around like that, I find them difficult to engage with because that's not how memory is lived, you know. It's much better to just tell the story as it happens and the revelations as they come, because that's much more effective a journey for the reader when they read it. It's a very soul-bearing book, and it's very exposing, and in a way that is quite difficult sometimes when you talk about it in public, because you know that people will, they may have read it already, or they'll be listening to you reading a section from it. There's something very freeing about that as well. There's something incredibly liberating about that. But there's no dirty linen, you know, everything's been said and done. And I think for me, that's partly to do with that very ingrained journey of going from shame to pride, that journey that we all go through. Hopefully we come out the other side of it, but we go on this journey from shame to pride. And my approach to that now is that to not be ashamed, to not be, you know, to own my mistakes and to say, yes, I did some stupid things. I did some very self-destructive things. I wasn't always very nice. I was often very impatient and very quick to judge people when I was younger. And I got into arguments with people that I really admired just because we disagreed about one tiny little thing. And I used to get really petty about that stuff and get into these petty squabbles with people. And if I can't be honest about those things, then what's the point of writing it? You know, it's be honest about it and just own it and move on. So I feel now that it's down, it's out there, and people are reading it. And the response has been extraordinary. I mean, I've just had the most incredible 6 months. The letters, the emails, the messages I've had from people in private, the private ones. Obviously, there's lots of public ones like Amazon reviews and stuff like this, which has been lovely to see as well, obviously. And to see that it's connected to people, people who lived through it, people who didn't live through it, people who had no idea what it was like, people who did and feel that they're being seen.
What was your family's reaction to the book? I mean, are those sort of in the book and close to you read the book as well?
My mum hasn't read it. My mum is not able to read anymore. She has dementia and Alzheimer's, and she's not able to read it. And I'm quite glad in a way, because I think my mum would find it quite difficult. My sister has read it, the one that I'm very close to, and she really loved it. Friends and my cousin, I'm very close to, she's like a sister to me, Elaine, she's read it and really loved it. People that have known me for a long time, some people that have known me all my life, were surprised by some of the things in it, because, you know, I realize this a lot as I get older, that, you know, we show certain sides of ourselves to certain people. And even though we may not do it intentionally, we kind of learn by a process of how a relationship with somebody develops, that there are certain aspects of ourselves that we connect with them. Maybe this is the person I go to when I'm talking about books. This is the person I go to when I want to go swimming, or whatever the interest may be you have in common. And they never hear the whole story. They have bits of the story. So people that have known me all my life, pretty much, my auntie Alma, who's my mum's best friend, read the book and been surprised by things because they had no idea. And there were some things I didn't tell my parents at the time. I didn't tell my parents that I nearly died of a drug overdose. Why would I tell my parents that at the time, you know? They would have only worried that I was going to do it again and end up in trouble again. It's been a bit of a... That was the most challenging part for me, really, was the book being published, and then everyone that needed to read it before it was published had already read it. I'd sent them advanced copies, so they'd already seen it. People that didn't need to read it, or lawyers, they read it once it was actually out in, you know, in public, once it was published. And that has been, for, yeah, I mean, not entirely, but for the overwhelming part, a really positive reception. There were some people that say, I wish you hadn't put that in, I wish you hadn't included that. But I was like, well, I'm sorry, it's part of my story. I can't explain myself to myself without referring to that episode in my life, because it was actually something that helped shape who I am. Somebody else may not think that it was relevant, but to me it's relevant. So I'm sorry, it's going to go in, you know. There were some things I left out. I made a decision very early on that I would only talk about certain behaviours and certain choices that I made, that I would only include other people if it was relevant. So there are lots of chapters in there where I talk about myself doing lots of drugs and being quite self-destructive and being very compulsive. And I don't include the other people who were present in that, because that's not my place. That's their story, not mine. But where it's somebody who's actually caused me harm or has you know, affected my life in a very deep and profound way through their actions, it's not my job to protect them either. So it was sort of striking that balance of, well, how do you give enough information for the reader to know what you're talking about and who you're talking about, and also the stuff that you can't put in because of legal reasons. So there were a few edits that were made because of lawyers, but not many. Most of it is in there.
Now, Paul, not only have you written beautiful stories, but also through your fabulous Polari, your literary salon, and of course the Polari Awards for emerging LGBTQ plus writers as well, you have promoted so many other beautiful books as well. That must be such a proud moment. The legacy of Paul Burston, I mean, is great, let me tell you, but that must be one thing that you are incredibly proud of. Polari, now an award-winning thing.
I started it out of frustration, you know, because I 2007, I launched Polari. In 2007, I published my third novel. It was my seventh or eighth book. I published nonfiction books as well. And I'd never once been invited to any kind of book festival. And I was so frustrated about that. And I thought, well, I can either sort of sit here and bitch and complain, or I can do something. So I thought, well, I'll just create my own platform. And that's very much the activist in me. that's very much the person that was in ACT UP, you know. This isn't happening. Why not? Let's make it happen. Let's create it ourselves. And once it was up and running, and I realized what the potential for it was, and I saw that it could actually go big, it sort of kicked in then. It's like, well, you've created a platform for yourself. Well done. How are you going to use it to benefit others? Because that's part of your job now. You know, once you've got something, I think your job is not to hold it all to yourself, but to share it. Once you have a platform that's been created in the name of diversity, you have to diversify. You can't just make it about promoting your own work all the time. Very quickly, it went from being Paul Burston's platform to being Paul Burston's platform for other people, and encouraging new and emerging writers, as well as established writers, because, you know, obviously we have the stars as well. But a huge part of it for me was about encouraging new and emerging writers. I mean, writers anyway are people who are often quite isolated in their activities, because we tend to write on our own, most of us. It's not very collaborative usually. And if you're part of a minority community on top of that, where the battles still to this day, I mean, things have got a bit better, but still, there are still things in your way if you're writing the kind of books that we're writing as a community on the whole, you know? There are still obstacles in publishing. Publishing is still very heterosexual, for the most part. So Polari was really about trying to address that and to try and offer opportunities for other writers from my community to have a platform. And creating the Polari Prize, which came in 2011, so 4 years after the salon launched, was really just a reflection of the kind of people that were coming to the salon and reading at the salon and talking to me about their work at the salon, and creating a prize that actually shone a light on them, because I know how publishing works. I've been involved in publishing a long time, and publishing loves free marketing. Publishing loves free marketing. You know, I remember being taken out for lunch by my editor and told about this new thing called MySpace, and how I needed to be on it so I could market myself and save them doing it for me. If you create a book prize, that creates free marketing opportunities. That creates publicity around a book list. That creates a sense of encouragement to the publishers that they should be doing more of this kind of thing, not less of it. So I think in a very significant way, I didn't think it would have such an impact as it has had, but I do believe very strongly that the Polari Prize has actually become part of the kind of ecology of publishing in this country. And it has become something that helps encourage allies and others in the publishing world, whether they're LGBTQ plus themselves or whether they're friends and allies, is encourage those people to push a bit more and create more stories, give more authors a chance. And I think that's been a really positive thing, and I'm very proud of this. It's the thing I'm most proud of, I think is that. I think that's my big contribution. My biggest contribution is that I've created something which is hopefully going forward going to continue to encourage and celebrate and amplify voices you wouldn't have heard from otherwise, because they're coming from the margins, and it's putting them into the mainstream, because Polari is a very mainstream event. Even though it's an LGBTQ plus themed event, we perform all over the country. We're funded by the Arts Council. We go into theatres, libraries, bookshops, nightclubs, bars, museums. We've even been on a race track, and we perform before audiences that are much broader than simply the community that we're representing. You know, our audience and our reach goes beyond that. So I think that's a really powerful message, that we're saying our stories are not only being told and being celebrated, they're being told to people outside of our community as well. And if we had more of that when I was young, I wouldn't have had as difficult a time as I did as a young queer person. I would have felt that my story was being told. I make this point in the book that, you know, stories are really important. Stories are how we make sense of ourselves. You know, we read stories as a kid to teach kids about ethics and morals and dangers and all these lessons that we get from fairy stories and children's books. If we can have representation in books that reflects us as young queer people, that's a really empowering, positive thing to give young queer people. If I'd had that, if I'd had Heartstopper when I was 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, that would have been a hugely beneficial thing for me. I think it's life-saving, literally life-saving. And telling stories and being able to tell them is a very liberating thing as well. So there's a sense of gay liberation that comes through that for me as well. And that really is probably the most important message. I think, you know, if you can encourage people to own their stories and tell their stories, who knows who that's going to help and how it's going to help them. But potentially it's a profoundly important connection.
It's a beautiful thing. If people want to find out more about the Polari events, because there's lots of them going on all the time, your website, paulburston.net, would be the best place to go for that, Paul, yeah?
No, go to the polarisalon.com website. It's all on there.
Fabulous stuff. Let's have a little bit of fun now. Five perfect dinner date guests, LGBTQ plus or otherwise. It's entirely up to you. Who would you pick and why?
Well, David Bowie would be number one because he was my guiding light and continues to be in many ways. I got to meet him once. I was very drunk at the time. I wish I hadn't been, but he was very charming. And what an amazing brain. I mean, he wasn't just a pop star or a rock musician. You know, he was a mentor because it was through Bowie that I learned about Oscar Wilde. It was through Bowie I learned about John Retchie, John Genet. I mean, he was a way into this other world of alternative, queer, often queer viewpoints. Debbie Harry, who was another one that I was obsessed with this from the time I was about 13, 14, and very luckily got to interview many years later, and she was so wonderful. Often they disappoint you, you know, because they're not larger than life. They're just regular people who happen to do something that creates celebrity around it. But she was one of the ones that she was everything I wanted her to be and more, because she was so funny and so quick-witted. She's hilarious. She's such a great laugh. I guess Oscar Wilde, because I think Wilde continues to fascinate me, even though there've been so many different. I've read so many books about Wilde. I've read so many different accounts of Wilde. I've seen so many different people portraying Wilde. You know, Stephen Fry, Rupert Everett, and everyone that writes about him or performs as him kind of shows a different version of him, because there were so many different versions of Wilde. His impact was so huge. He was like a rock star, really. You know, his impact on the culture was so huge. There aren't many writers that have that kind of level of impact. So I think he'd be fascinating. I'm sure he'd be very difficult as well. Who else? Gosh, how many more? Have I got two more?
Two more places at the table.
So I'd want somebody who was going to be very difficult, probably, because when you have a good dinner party, you always have that one guest who's quite rude. Now, who am I going to label with the rude brush? I don't know. Can it be a fictional character as well? Does it need to be a real person?
Absolutely. It can be anybody you like. This is fantasy time.
Then I'd probably pick a character from a Wilde story, like Algernon from The Importance of Being Earnest, because I love that play so much. And it's got so much to say still, that play. I mean, every time I read it or see it performed, I come away with a different take on it. And Algernon is the character that I most identified with when I was young. When I say I was in the play, I literally played like a footman. I had like three lines. I was so bad. But the guy playing Algernon was fantastic. So I think Algernon from The Importance of Being Earnest. And then probably just because I love the story so much growing up, Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh. When you read those books as an adult, you see what the writer's doing. But as a kid, you just accept it on face value. And the fact that there's this clearly depressed donkey. Now, Eeyore's depressed and is clearly suffering from depression. And the other characters just include Eeyore anyway, you know? So even though Eeyore is not much fun and is a bit miserable and always sees the worst of everything, always sees the worst, you know, it's so wonderfully written, those Milne books. They're so witty and clever. And the way that Eeyore comments on things is always finding the negative in any situation, you know? I've been a bit Eeyore-ish in my life, and I still have the capacity to be a little bit Eeyore-ish occasionally. So I think having Eeyore there will be a reminder of where I shouldn't go, as well as being entertaining.
I was not expecting that answer, but it's a brilliant answer, Paul Burston. What's your best experience that you've ever had, or maybe most memorable experience in an LGBTQ plus safe space?
Well, the most memorable was going to heaven the first time, because I don't think anyone ever forgets their first time in a queer space. I'd never been in a queer space until then. And typical me, I don't just go to my local gay bar. I go into the biggest, scariest gay nightclub in London. And it was terrifying. I mean, first of all, I didn't even go in the first time. I went there and I stood outside smoking and then left. And then I did the same the second Saturday. And then on the third Saturday, I finally got the courage to go in. And I remember descending the staircase, and the first thing I heard was a guy push, sort of swish past, going, "So many men, so little time," which was a song at the time, "So Many Men, So Little Time," Miguel Brown. And it was horrifying. I was so scared. You know, it was so overwhelming. I didn't feel that I'd come home. I didn't feel that I'd found my place yet, but I knew that it was a step in the right direction. And I felt that I was coming out to myself by going there and saying, I think, you know, by walking into a queer space, you're basically saying to everyone in that space, "Hello, I'm queer." You know, you're saying that by being there. And especially if you go on your own, which is not probably the best way to do it probably, but it's what I did. So if you never forget the feeling of that, of feeling seen and seeing other people. And I remember seeing, like, I'm not going to name them, but I remember seeing certain people that were in the public eye that I didn't know were gay, and they were there. You know, so it was like, "Oh my God, I didn't know about that person. They're here. My God," you know. Back in those days, we didn't have lots of out gay celebrities. I think Jimmy Somerville and Andy Bell were some of the few that I knew of. I mean, had I known then that one day I would be on that stage performing with Polari, I mean, that's unthinkable to me. But that 19-year-old going into heaven that first time, if you told him that one day he'd be on that main stage, he would never have believed you. So that's probably the one I'd have to choose.
It would have been mind blown. What's the song that's guaranteed to get you on that club dance floor?
I think it would have to be "Do You Want to Funk" by Sylvester. I was at a little pop-up club in St. Leonard's, down in Hastings, at the weekend, and it's run by these fantastic 20-something guys, and it's called Laundry Day, and it's the sort of LGBT pop-up club that I think they do it like once every 3 months or something, and they play the most fantastic mixture of music, both old and new, and they always play this song, and it's fantastic to see that song. More so than Mighty Reel, actually, which I love Mighty Reel, but "Do You Want to Funk?" It's got such an amazingly contemporary-sounding sexual beat to it. It's so sexy, and it's so upfront, and it's so in your face, and it's so exciting. And to see these young kids dancing to this song that I was dancing to when I was their age and younger, and it's still having that impact now. It's still getting queer people up on a dance floor. "Do you want?" I mean, obviously, the pun in "Do You Want to Funk?" We all know what that's referring to, and you can see the excitement on people's faces when they're dancing to it. It's so fantastically sexy, and Sylvester was such an amazing person. I mean, what an extraordinary gift! What an extraordinary talent! So sad that we lost him. You know, he was extraordinary, Sylvester, and that record is just full of sexuality and joy and freedom and liberation and all those positive things coming from this very disenfranchised, black, queer, effeminate man who had, you know, died of AIDS. It's a life force. Now, that song is so full of life. I love it so much.
It is a tune and a half. Have you ever done the gay old time on holiday? Have you ever done the sort of classic gay holiday, or do you indeed remember your first?
I've done it many times. My God. Gran Canaria. Yeah, Gran Canaria. I've been many times to Gran Canaria. I first went there on a press trip. I knew nothing about it and went on a press trip and got very, very badly sunburned, because despite them telling you to put on heavy sunscreen, because it, you know, it's a Spanish territory, but it's, you're in African climate. I got very, very burnt because I didn't listen. I remember going to the Yumbo Center the first time and discovering the joys of the Yumbo Center. And that whole thing that's, that they do there, and they do a lot often in Spain, where people go to one bar at, say, 10 o'clock, and then at 11 o'clock, everyone disappears en masse to the next bar. And if you don't realize, you get left behind and you don't know where you're meant to go. So I quite enjoyed that kind of migratory, going around the bars thing. I go to Sitges still a lot. I love Sitges. I think Sitges is the perfect balance, really, between being a kind of quite sort of touristy, gay, touristy destination, but still retains a strong sense of the local Catalan community and sort of sensibility. And those two things coexist in a very happy way. There's something very liberating about Spain. I've always been very drawn to Spain since I was quite young. I think there's something about it that's very, it's probably that kind of having gone through living under military dictatorship with Franco and then all the freedoms that came afterwards. And the sort of, you don't take that for granted then. You know, you don't take freedoms for granted when you grew up without them. So there's a real sense in Spain that let's live for today. Let's enjoy the freedom we're having now. And let's, you know, live life to the max. And obviously that, you know, fits in very, very neatly with gay sensibility, which is often about those very, very same feelings and sensations and ideas, living life to the max. So yeah, those are the two that I'd probably say were the most significant for me.
You have lived such a beautiful, you know, technicoloured life, Paul Burston, you really have. But is there one particular moment, one rainbow-flavoured moment that you are most proud of?
I would have said, until recently, I would have said being on Westminster Bridge on World AIDS Day in 1990 with ACT UP, blocking the traffic, raising awareness around the fact that the Thatcher government was defunding lots of, you know, revenue streams that were there to help people with HIV and AIDS. That was probably the most important moment in my life and one where I felt that I was visibly making a difference. But I think now I'd have to say on stage at Heaven with Polari, or being on stage at the British Museum with the Polari Prize, being on a platform that I've created with the people that I'm sharing that platform with, amplifying and celebrating and giving a voice, or giving an opportunity rather, to those people to share their work and their voices. That's probably the thing that I think is probably how I'd like to be thought of when I'm gone, that I was that person that did that.
You have been so many people and such an inspirational person to so many people out there as well. Paul Burston, it's been an absolute pleasure spending time with you today. Thanks for joining us on the podcast, and thanks for showing us that you have had indeed a gay old time.
My pleasure.
That's it for this episode of A Gay Old Time. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Paul as much as I did. If you'd like to experience more rainbow joy, then please subscribe and follow the podcast on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you're listening to me right now. And do share it to anyone else you think would love to listen in. Thanks a million to Juliet at Pineapple Audio Production for making everything so sparkly and gorgeous. I will be back soon with another episode featuring a deep and meaningful with an inspirational individual. Until then, from me, Nigel May, sending all the love and hoping that whatever you're up to, if it applies to you, you're having a gay old time. Enjoy.